And welcome to the Anarchist Book Club with Danny Evans and me, Jim Yeoman. In this episode, we discuss our first ever ABC edition pamphlet, a translation of Victor Garcia's José Chena Torrens, a contribution to a necessary biography. Danny has taken the lead on this project and introduces us to Garcia, which is the pen name of the activist Germinal Garcia, his relationship with Chena, and the experiences of both through the Spanish Civil War and exile in Venezuela. The pamphlet is going to be available at cost price of £2 plus any postage costs. You can email abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com to discuss placing an order for one. Big thanks to Footprint Workers Co-op in Leeds for the printing of this lovely edition. Check them out at footprinters.co.uk. So we're going to talk today about a very exciting new development, which is the pamphlet that we've had published in our name. I'm going to be totally honest up front. This has been mainly Danny's project. I've been providing moral support, but not much else. So we thought it'd be a really nice idea to talk about this pamphlet that we've had printed, an edition of Victor Garcia's José Chena Torrens, a contribution to a necessary biography, which will be available for people to get hold of. And I thought it'd be a good chance to chat to Danny about this project, why he took it up, why we're putting this out now, and the people that wrote it. So could you give a sense of like what this pamphlet is, where it comes from, what kind of document it is that we're looking at?
This is effectively an obituary that was published in two parts by the Spanish anarchist magazine Orto in the 80s. Orto had been the name of a quite famous heterodox anarchist publication in the 30s, edited by somebody called Marín Cervera, that was published from a panoply of different positions on the sort of anarchist or anarchist adjacent left, and is a really interesting publication in its own right. So anyway, this name was resuscitated under the editorship of Ramón Sentís, who was a Catalan anarchist who had been exiled in Venezuela, which is also where Victor Garcia, the author of this pamphlet, and José Chena were also spent the majority of their exile after the Spanish Civil War. So it's an obituary in two parts, but it's titled A Contribution to a Necessary Biography. Why would this biography be necessary? Well, José Chena, who's the subject of the obituary slash biography, was a fairly prominent anarchist in Barcelona during the Spanish Civil War. And if listeners have heard of him, it's probably because he's famous for being the one person who voted against the CNT's participation in the Central Committee of Anti-Fascist Militia, which was a kind of ad hoc administrative organization set up at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War in Barcelona, and was controversial because it represented the CNT entering a kind of governmental administration alongside political bodies like Catalan nationalists, socialists, and dissident communists. So that was a controversial maneuver, and was considered the first step on the way to the CNT collaborating with the state more formally during the Spanish Civil War. So Chena was like this lone voice in this meeting that took place in July 1936. Lone voice is to mischaracterize it. He was the lone vote against this collaboration taking place. For that reason alone, he's an interesting figure that, I think that when you find that out, if you're interested in Spanish anarchism, then your antennae twitch and you think, well, who was this person? What was he about? What did he get up to and stuff? So this translating this obituary, which runs, to sort of around, 8,000 words in the translation, is a way for readers who are unfamiliar with his life to find out more about, his general trajectory. There is a bit more written about him in Spanish. So if you've read José Peyrat's autobiography and things like that, then, he's somebody who appears a few times in that, but generally not especially well known, I would say. And the author, Victor Garcia was a pen name of Tomás Gracia Ibarz, who was known to everybody as Germinal. So generally referred to as Germinal Gracia. He's one of the anarchists that I feel most admiration for, when reading about like obviously researching these people and their lives and things, they feel like a great deal of like admiration for their collective achievements and you know what the movement represented, what it fought for. But like just the sort of life of Herman Algrathia, I just think as sort of exemplary. You know, I'm sure like everyone he had like faults and things, but just I'll give a brief like sort of sketch of overview of his life, and I think it will kind of be apparent like why people might find like this person admirable, you know. So he was born in Aragon, but they moved to Barcelona at a young age, and that's where he sort of was formed. Very little schooling, started work at a young age, like quite lots of like that generation. And was still young when the Spanish Civil War started. Was still a teenager, but he was already an anarchist and already a member of the CNT. Like was the case really with a lot of activists. You know, when you read about their lives, you know, they had to grow up very quickly. You know, they start work very young. Often their exposure to ideas, to literacy, comes about through entering a workplace, meeting like anarchist activists or union activists and things like this. So. You know, it was quite possible for people to become like activists at a very young age, and that was the case for him. He took part in the early days of the Civil War, like volunteered to go and fight at the front, but was sent home because they thought he was too young, basically. You know, like this was happening a lot, you know, in this kind of the ways in which people were volunteering for the front in quite a like spontaneous manner, you know, and whether they'd be accepted or not was often like on the say-so of like more senior militants in these columns. And there's a brilliant story in Antonia Fontanias's, I think it was published in Italian, like a short memoir she wrote. She was like 16, I think, when the Spanish Civil War started. Her parents were both anarchists. She went with two of her friends, two other young women or like, you know, teenagers, to volunteer for the expedition that was going to Mallorca to try and liberate Mallorca. That was the main body of volunteers that were recruited by the Maritime Transport Union of the CNT. So the three of these like teenagers, young women, went along to volunteer, and they present themselves to Juan Yagüe, who was the secretary of the CNT's Maritime Transport Union, and say, look, we want to join the expedition. And he says, well, no, you know, patriarchal, sexist, or possibly those like sentiments overlapping with a kind of like sense of, you know, paternal kind of worry that, you know, right, you've fought in like street fighting before, like experienced this kind of like life and death situation before. I'm like, feel like I'm making a conscious decision as an adult to take part in this fight. But, you know, here are these like kids being presented to me, you know, am I going to be able to like look their parents in the face kind of thing, you know? So he says to them, no, like I'm not, you know, you're not allowed to come on the boat. You can be useful to the revolution in other ways, whatever. And they say, come off it, you know, how can you, an anarchist, you're committed to equality, you don't believe in like these kind of hierarchical instructions where you can like force your authority on us. We've decided freely that we want to go and fight. So that's what we're going to do. So let us on. And he's like, do you know what? You're right. So they get on the boat. Then Antonio Fontanias' dad turns up and is like, Juan, you know, you've got to get them off the boat. And Juan Yagüe is like, suddenly, you know, is like with the zeal of a convert, is like the big anti-sexist, anti-patriarchal person. It's like, how can you say this? You know, we're anarchists, you know, how can you be imposing your authority on your daughter and what have you? And Antonio Fontanias' dad was like, come on, it's not me, it's her mum. And Antonia and one of her mates ended up getting off the boat, but the other one went on to fight at the front. But just, this is just to illustrate the kind of unsystematic way in which this was happening at the time. You know, like people would be maybe commended for their youthful enthusiasm. People like delighted to see people like volunteering and other people like upset and like worried, you know, what are we doing? Like letting the youth be exposed to these kind of dangers, you know. Presumably Herminal, the young Herminal, like experienced both of that in his like initial volunteering for the front. So he's sent back to the rear guard. He gets involved in an affinity group with Diego Camacho, who was later better known by the pen name Abel Paz, who wrote like a famous biography of Durruti, among other important works. And Liberto Serrao, an anarchist activist, especially in the libertarian youth, but would later be also involved in the anti-Francoist resistance, spent a long time in jail and things like this. Also in their affinity group was an Argentinian called Raul Carballeira, who would later die, probably killed by the Barcelona police while in hiding after a shootout in the center of Barcelona under, you know, during the years of Francoism. So he was a part of this affinity group, which was called Quijotes del Ideal, which published an anti-collaboration newspaper during the years of the Civil War. Germinal was active in the libertarian youth. He was active through this affinity group. He was active in his union, the CNT. He and like others in the affinity group went to work in one of the collectives during the revolutionary period as well, like just helping out in the collectives, and they set up a school. And he also went to the front towards the end of the war as well. Then he spent time in concentration camps in France after the fall of Barcelona, and then was involved or liaised with the French resistance as a member of the CNT in the underground in after the fall of France during the Second World War, was arrested and was actually being transferred from one concentration camp to Dachau by the Nazis among a group of several who were considered dangerous elements. So this is towards the end of the Second World War, when Dachau was like, you know, being sent there was pretty much a death sentence. He's on this wagon to Dachau, and he and his colleagues managed to escape, or a few of them managed to escape, by prizing open the floorboards of this wagon with like forks, cutlery that they managed to have on them. And this was made even more extraordinary by the fact that they were transferred from one, you know, train to another on various points. So they would have to, like, they would started trying to prize open these floorboards, and then would have to stop and then, you know, be transferred to another train and then start again, lower themselves from a moving train when it was like moving a bit more slowly, you know, to get onto the tracks and then escape and then make contact with the resistance again. And during this time in the camps, he spent time in a succession of camps during the course of the Second World War, he was teaching himself languages. Like, the people who were detained with him attested to the fact that, you know, he had like a tremendous like sort of self-discipline, in the sense of like, even in these like appalling situations, practicing English, practicing French, practicing Esperanto, like wanting to teach, wanting to learn, you know, just amazing. Like, you know, one of these, like, I suppose there are lots of stories from this, like, you know, these very extremely bleak moments when, you know, human resilience is like really, it can really like sort of demonstrate itself, can't it, when people like manage to like retain like the sense of like self and like of purpose and things like that, despite like the horrendous situation that they're in. Subsequent to the Second World War, he was in France and took part in this conference where the libertarian youth reconstituted itself. But he felt guilty because other of his comrades, you know, were still in Spain, like fighting in the underground. So he smuggled himself back over the border. He was then in the Franco, anti-Franco underground in Barcelona, was lifted, spent time in prison, helped put out a prison newspaper, and then was released in the very brief like thawing of like Francoist repression in the 40s, when it seemed that, you know, that the international community would like sort of force Franco into like making some sort of concessions to civil rights. So when he was out again, he was like involved in like, you know, setting up the CNT underground, and they had a visitor or somebody come who said they'd come from Madrid and was fleeing from the Francoist police. But Germinal and his colleagues were a bit worried about whether this person was legitimate or not, or like maybe like, you know, had been sent to spy on them. So they arranged to meet him in Plaza Urquinaona, which is like in central Barcelona. And they're walking around the square, chatting to this person, and they have to give a signal to their colleagues who are like hiding around the place to say, okay, this person's legit, or actually we think this person's a spy. They keep going around, and they obviously haven't made their mind up, and the people like who are hiding get nervous and think, okay, we're gonna have to like sort of force the issue. So they come out to hide in and approach them, and as if they were playing close policemen, ask to see the papers, at which point this person, who it turns out was in actual fact a police spy, takes his gun out, and then like it turns out there's loads of like plainclothes police around the place, and there's like a gun battle. Like, one of the anarchists is killed, another one escapes but with a bullet in the stomach. He's later able to get cured and get over the border, and Germinal and his friend Raúl Carballera both escape, and Carballera goes to the gardens around the Montjuïc fortress on one side of Barcelona, and Germinal escapes to the gardens around Mont Tibidabo. Germán García wasn't discovered, and he was later able to make his way across the border. In the meantime, the police had kidnapped his mother and were holding her hostage in an attempt to force him to give himself up. Raúl Caballero was less fortunate and was discovered by the police and was killed. At this point, Germán García decided to leave for Venezuela. He writes to the local police authorities in Barcelona from Venezuela saying, look, I'm in Venezuela. Please let my mum go now. You know, I'm not like obviously able to do anything. So they do, they release his mum. And I think like that was a big part of his decision to actually to go, you know, thinking like, how am I going to extricate my mum from this situation? But he doesn't like give up anarchist activity. And, you know, he doesn't like return to taking those same kinds of like risks and things in terms of the underground. But what he does subsequently is a vast labor of translation, publication, correspondence, and like sort of permanent kind of like networking in a bid to like both like keep anarchist networks in exile going, but also to like expand the vision of European anarchists, essentially to like to have a more like international understanding of the world, of events, of history, and so on. He traveled extensively, you know, was a multilingualist, had a total commitment to history, to like to try and understand things, to I suppose an ethics of internationalism and of humanism. So that's why I find like Germán García like individually fascinating. You know, some of his stuff has been translated, but there's loads of stuff that hasn't. And I just it, like if you admire somebody that much, then like, you know, it's like just a sort of small contribution to their memory, really, I suppose, to try and like translate stuff that they've written. It's not the first thing I've translated. I've translated little bits and Bob's on the blog and stuff on the Substack. But I thought this would be like a more substantial piece to make more widely available. And also, you know, it has the added benefit of bringing like José Chena's life to like slightly wider attention as well. The reason we decided to like that it might be a nice idea to publish it as a pamphlet as opposed to just sticking it on Libcom or whatever, or just sticking it on the Substack. But I just want to say as well, like I will stick it on Libcom at some point. I've got obviously no objection to that. I just personally find that like there's so much stuff on Libcom that, you know, I'd like to read at some point that I never read because like I find like reading on a screen difficult, so if I can get myself like I'm much more easily distracted. But if those things existed in like a cheap pamphlet that I picked up at a book fair or whatever, then I would read it. I just feel like publishing it in this form hopefully would lead to a few more people actually reading it rather than just keeping it open on one tab among like 3,000.
You've painted such a vivid picture of the author's life here, which I think is great because, you know, where I've come at it is from reading García's piece on someone else. So to have almost your biography of García there really adds then to this pamphlet and to see it, well, as something as a bit of a double header. You know, you get the sense of José Chena's life through this, but you also get some of García, and I think that what you've spoken about there kind of completes that sort of sense of these are two people who knew each other, they encountered one another, they got to know each other and became friends, and then at times weren't so close. Thinking about some of the things that García then discusses about José Chena's life, it's interesting to think about, for me, the things that he chooses to highlight. And one of the words that Victor García chooses, you know, to really emphasize, one of the characteristics that García chooses to emphasize is Chena's intransigence. You know, it's a word that comes up a few times in the pamphlet and he really stresses it quite early on. Maybe it makes sense to start with those years of the Civil War. And going back to that sort of very early moment, this famous meeting in Barcelona in the early days of the Civil War, where it's now, you know, fairly clear that Chena was the lone vote against the kind of collaboration with this broader anti-fascist coalition. And that's one key example of this intransigence. Interesting that Juan García Oliver remembers it. You know, he doesn't name Chena. I thought that was really really quite striking, given that he almost certainly would have known who this delegate was, you know, but perhaps we can start with this moment.
Like, I think the way he sort of says it as well, like Victor, I suppose, like when I'm talking about like what he's written, I'll use like the pen name. So the way Victor Garcia talks about it is that, you know, it's pretty unusual. It's pretty unlikely even, or that the way that like Juan García Oliver in his autobiography, which has so many like names and things, and like apparently remembers all kinds of like conversations and details and stuff with like specific individuals, is thinking back to like, and this is really in many ways the centerpiece of this autobiography. You know, he doesn't remember, even though like he had like, it was a, you know, a fairly close working relationship with Jose Chana, subsequently doesn't remember that it was him who like, who voted for the position that, you know, he, Juan García Oliver, had advocated in this meeting. Just seems a little bit unlikely. So I think it, in some ways, I mean, because it's hard to know really, like who's the obituary for, you know, is Victor García thinking like in terms of posterity, in terms of like historians reading this stuff? I mean, Orto's like many of these kind of publications was basically read by, by, I suppose by the time Orto exists in the 80s, you know, you've got like Spanish, like anarchists in Spain, you know, Franco's dead and stuff. There's a revived movement to an extent. And so some younger people and things will be reading this. But, you know, a lot of the readership for this stuff was like people who were older, who had lived through like exile and things like that. So maybe it's just like a kind of acknowledgement that like, you know, we know, you know, we the readers know this kind of stuff. So like, I'm just like, you know, gesturing to what is common knowledge, you know, that this was Chena who raised the vote. If you think of like, say, Juan García Oliver, Federico Montsen, Diego Abad de Santillán, people who were at that meeting, that this particular meeting, that which decided that the CNT would collaborate in the Central Committee of Anti-Fascist Militias, those are like what you'd, I suppose, call like the big names. They would like thought of as the notables, right? The notable like members of the organization. Chena wasn't like totally apart from that. What actually like reading, like translating this and like writing the afterword to it has made me sort of think is that you have to like kind of think between the like kind of big names, like the leadership and the mid-level. I tend to be interested in union delegates, like affinity group delegates and things like this, people who are like attending lots of meetings who are extremely active and stuff like that, but who aren't, you know, making executive decisions, especially during the Civil War. Between them, there is this like sort of regional leadership stratum, which during the Civil War ends up including people like Chena. And it's a kind of fuzzy, it's a kind of fuzzy category, I think, between like the top level and the mid-level. I don't think they necessarily recognize themselves as being like separate, but something like the May Days really like highlights the difference, because you've got mid-level activists like Julián Merino, secretary of the transport union in Barcelona, and the local FI secretary, helping to coordinate this like uprising of anarchist activists. Then you've got the actual national leadership, you know, Federico Montsen, Rodríguez Báquez, and Juan García Oliver, who come over from Valencia to Barcelona to appeal to the anarchist workers to come away from the barricades. And you've got the regional leadership who are really in the middle. I don't think they really understood, like they didn't have a clear handle on what was going on the streets in terms of like who was coordinating and stuff like that. I don't think anyway, or at least that's how it comes across from Juan García Oliver's autobiography. Like when he storms in to their meeting, like and says, you know, who's organizing this? What's going on? The regional leadership say they don't know. But they also, I don't think the regional leadership, I don't think really appreciated like how much of a like a kind of shock and catastrophe and disaster the May Days seemed to the national leadership. You know, I think their angle was, the workers are showing their teeth, so we can use this as a bargaining position and we can improve our situation. You know, I don't think they were thinking, you know, we'll call everybody off the barricades. They were thinking, okay, these are our people, how can we sort of like work this situation? And then the national leadership come in and say, you know, this is a disaster, get everyone off the barricades, you know, go home, forget it. So like you can see like there's different levels there. Herman Algracia, who later, you know, wrote under the pen name Victor Garcia, is like one rung even below that. Like, he's not really a mid-level activist at this point. He's an activist at, I suppose you'd say, the grassroots level. You know, he's in an affinity group, but the affinity group wasn't even like affiliated to the FI. So at that point, they weren't like being sent as delegates to like FI meetings and things like this. By the end of the Civil War, I suppose he was becoming like more of what you'd call a mid-level militant, in the sense that I think once you're like a part of that mid-level, then your name like appears in like minutes of meetings and things. You would obviously be like somebody who's known to other like activists, not necessarily just people in your workplace or just in your affinity group and things like that. You'd be like somebody who's like slightly better known. And I think Herman Algracia would ultimately sort of have that role just by like taking on like some positions of responsibility in the libertarian youth towards the end of the war. Between him and Chena, there's a generational difference, because like Chena's like significantly older and was already like fairly influential by the time of the Civil War as an activist. And there's also that difference in sort of status within the movement as well, that Chena, especially by the end of the Civil War, was a member of the regional leadership, arguably, you know, by the very fact that he was present at this meeting in July 1936, which was a rapidly assembled meeting, a kind of ad hoc thing where they got together people who they thought were of note to debate this position and make it clear. And so the fact that he was like brought in at that point is suggestive. Yeah, so they were at different levels, basically. When they converge and act as like comrades with one another is primarily in exile. They did encounter one another, as Victor Garcia relates in the pamphlet, during the Civil War. But towards the end, when Chena had joined this liaison committee, which was formerly the executive committee of the libertarian movement in Spain, it was a very controversial body, which Victor Garcia talks about in his pamphlet. Herman Algracia would also be a delegate of the libertarian youth in the liaison committee, as it later became known. And he talks about, like, you know, encountering Chena in this capacity. Obviously, then as well, their differences in status in terms of weight within the movement, you know, within organizations that were becoming increasingly hierarchical and bureaucratized and stuff, was a pretty significant difference. But that didn't stop them becoming close friends in the very different, obviously, circumstances of Venezuelan exile. When Herman Algracia arrived, he was taken in by the family. And Nereida Chena, who is Jose Chena's daughter, who, you know, basically this pamphlet wouldn't have happened without her. She provided this short preface, remembering her dad, but she also provided these like two like wonderful photos of Herman Algracia and Jose Chena together. She has related that, you know, when Herman Algracia arrived in Venezuela, it was like a great thing, you know, for her family, you know, for her brother and like other like young people within the Spanish exile community, because he was like such a, you know, he was such a nice fella. He would like take the kids out on trips and things like this. He had like a Jeep and they would go on like excursions. He would teach them songs and things. And, you know, he was basically just an all round sound fella. But like as a result of this, he became like very like sort of involved in the Chena family. You know, he's like one more in the family, which made it particularly painful when he and Chena had a big like political falling out as a result of the sort of internal politics of the CNT in exile in like 1960. Yeah, so to get back to that point about intransigence, because it's also something that Nereida Chena in her preface mentions. Herman Algracia says that this is like, you know, the main quality that people remember about Chena is his intransigence. And I think like during exile, he became like a very strict defender of anarchist orthodoxy. And there's actually like a telling anecdote in Jose Peyrat's autobiography. Peyrat and Chena had been like somewhat rivals for a long time when they'd both competed to be the delegates for Baix Llobregat, the region of Catalonia, at national plenums and congresses and things. So there wasn't a great deal of love lost between them, although, you know, I think there was like sort of mutual respect as well. Anyway, when Peyrat's made it to Venezuela in the 40s. He was then sent to be the delegate for the Venezuelan region of the CNT in exile at this Congress, of the movement. And he was told by Chena, you know, you've got to stick up for the orthodox position here. You know, you've got to be like, stand up for like intransigent anarchism. And like, we're not going to make any deals with other political parties in order to like fight Franco. You know, we're going to like stick to a kind of purely anarchist position. And Peyrats was like, well, you know, you've changed the tune because, you know, you went along with collaboration, you know, during the war. And Chena said, well, we've rectified our position. And Peyrats said, you know, obviously using a metaphor, it was when you were wearing epaulettes that you needed to rectify your position, not now, you know, effectively saying, you know, what good is intransigence now in exile, like when the revolution has been defeated? Curious in a way that he has this reputation for intransigence when the big sort of enigma of his life, when you just take it at least, you know, at face value, is that he goes from this intransigent position of opposing collaboration at the beginning of the Civil War to ultimately participating in collaboration.
Thinking about those changes in Chena's position, I think that's one of the real strengths of Garcia's obituary, you know, just taking in the broad sweep of Chena's life, of the moments in which these characteristics came through, the moments in which they changed or were compromised. You know, it really gives this broader sense beyond that moment, I guess, from which he's known. You know, allows an effort to understand where he got to at various points, why he made the decisions he did, why in 1936 he made that decision, why during the May Days he made perhaps a different position, and why in 1960, when there's this kind of big rupture in the exile community, you know, he perhaps made a different thing. And, you know, it's not so easy to say someone is X or Y when you're talking about a life where things kind of flip and change. I think the exile side, you know, this to me, you know, someone less familiar with that period of Spanish anarchism, is one of the more fascinating ones. And you get this kind of slice of a life through Garcia's eyes of what Chena's doing, and the value of what he does on perhaps what's seen as a less celebrated or less studied or less kind of laudatory phase of the Spanish anarchist movement, its time in exile. To me, that was the real new information and the stuff that I found really kind of rich and valuable, even if, you know, perhaps less, you know, seismic. One thing, I guess, you know, if we're talking through intransigence or changes of opinion and these kind of political questions about Chena's life, I guess on the other side of that, one thing that is a constant and it's something, you know, that really chimed with me, but it was his relationship and work with his wife and his relationship and work with education, which was very, very tightly bound in with that, with Aramania. Like, I really loved the account that, you know, they met at this kind of traditional Catalan singing and dancing in the streets. And, you know, and Aramania says that she, you know, she thinks she's found the man that she'll spend her life with. And it sounds like that's very astute for someone who's then a 19-year-old. And perhaps again, away from the seismic events of the Civil War, it seems like Aramania is the one kind of focal point of Chena's life.
It seems like Aramania was like somebody who was interested in the ideas and was like an Esperantist and stuff like that. The thing is, though, that just I've been thinking about recently, that sort of gives me pause about, like, I don't know, like making assumptions one way or the other, basically, about these kind of relationships that especially like anarchist like men or like prominent anarchist men had with their partners. You know, a lot of the time, like the women have names like Aramania or Vida or something like this, right? You know, names that evoke nature and stuff, which were not the names that they were given as kids, but names that they adopted. Some of the, like the children of these relationships, when they talk about this, instead of, they don't say, my mum changed her name to this. They say, this was the name my dad always called my mum. It makes it seem like you get into a relationship with an anarchist man and he rebaptizes you with a name appropriate for an anarchist woman, which, sure, that makes it sound worse than it will have been in most cases, you know. And Aramania seems like the kind of person who could stand up for herself and stuff. But like, I think Nereda uses that expression in the preface, you know, this is what my dad called my mum, which is not like the same, obviously, as this is what my mum called herself. But, you know, who knows, really, the sort of complexities of those kind of situations. But yeah, it seems like very clear that his home, like his domestic life and stuff, was not totally separate from his politics and his ideas, you know, that he, Victor Garcia, relates how he like had a blackboard set up in, you know, in any house that he lived in, even when he lived in like very, very small like accommodations and things in the Dominican Republic in exile. He would always like create space for like teaching, and like those kind of like teaching sessions wouldn't just be for his own kids, you know, they'd be for like kids in the neighborhood and stuff like that. You know, there was like a kind of full commitment that obviously, you know, the family must have been on board with to a degree. Like a lot of these like anarchist parents, they're remembered as being strict. You know, they weren't, the kids weren't encouraged to go out dancing to like, you know, when rock and roll came out and stuff like that. These kinds of like pursuits weren't encouraged. There was like a strictness, an emphasis on high culture and stuff like this, which like, you know, gives an impression of a bit of joylessness occasionally, but as well, like a real emphasis on education, you know, and like of learning as a beautiful thing, and like a kind of purpose of living in a way that I think like gave, you know, even like, you know, younger people, you know, the children of these anarchists who didn't like go on to be anarchists when they were older themselves, you know, retain that sense of like, you know, the importance of learning and stuff like that. And like, you know, how learning can enrich a life and things. Well, so I was going to say one other thing. Oh, yeah. Apparently, Jose Chena loved football. He absolutely loved footy and would watch any football match that was on, you know, regardless of like, you know, what country it was from, whatever, you know, any footy, he was like bang into it, which is like, I think the one thing about his life that is like really non-standard for an anarchist man of that, a Spanish anarchist man of that generation, because you know, you read a lot of like, especially the exile press in the 50s and 60s and things, when you've got young Spanish people leaving Spain for work opportunities, not for political reasons, and the anarchist exiles like really want to make contact with these people who are leaving, you know, to find out what's going on in Spain, to like sort of make contact with the actually existing Spanish workforce and stuff. And, you know, they're like full of complaints about them because all that, you know, they're just interested in football, basically. And they're like, you know, football is like a kind of, is a key tool of like the Francoist state, you know, like Real Madrid and all this kind of stuff, or Barcelona, whoever it may be, you know, like it's just entertainment, it's just spectacle. You passively consume it. Basically, you know, it's the new opium of the masses. But Jose Chena was like, nah, it's boss. And I watched every game going and not playing it, watching it on telly.
Thanks for listening. You can keep in touch with the podcast via email, abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com, and via Twitter @abcdannyandjim. You can subscribe to our newsletter at abcwithdannyandjim.substack.com. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra and Rafael Dinosio, Gente de Miña Tierra. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo, and the image in this episode is a photograph of Jimenel Gracia, or Victor Garcia, and Jose Chena, from their time in exile, taken around 1960. This photograph features in the pamphlet and was generously supplied by Jose Chena's daughter, Nerida Chena Puig. I remind you that if you're interested in getting hold of the pamphlet, it is available at a cost price of £2 plus any postage costs. You can get in touch with us via our email, abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com, to place an order. Love and solidarity. Until next time.
senhor secretário de Estado, faz favor, tenha a palavra.
Senhora Presidente.